This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. It has been estimated that at any one time, something like half of all Americans are confronting some kind of civil legal problem. And for many of them, getting legal help can be very difficult. It is available for people who can't afford to hire a lawyer or don't have a lot of money. But the truth of the matter is that access to that kind of help varies a great deal, and it depends a lot on where you live. Our guest for this hour, Rebecca Sandifer, professor of sociology at University of Illinois, says that in criminal court, as probably most people know, defendants have a right to a lawyer, but on the civil side, there is no such guarantee. This morning, we'll be talking about a report which she authored. Access Across America is what it's called, and it's the first national survey of services available to help people seeking civil justice. It has recently been published by the American Bar Foundation. It is something that's available on the web, so if people would like to read it and take a look at how Illinois, for example, stands and stacks up against other states, it's something that is easy to find. And we're very pleased to have Professor Sandifer here in the studio with us to talk a little bit about the report and also about this issue. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. For people that would like to send an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, and maybe, again, the place is to begin, kind of as I did, was just to remind people, and I'm sure that people know, they understand that when a person is charged with a crime, if they can't afford a lawyer, one is provided.
Absolutely.
But yeah. This is a completely, we're talking here about a different situation, civil cases, and in that particular case, that constitutional guarantee that you can have a lawyer, this doesn't apply.
That's right. And that would be true, for instance, if you were living in an apartment and your landlord moved to evict you. And you had to appear in court to defend yourself against that eviction, for example, you might be able to find some help, but you have no right to help with that kind of legal process. You also have no right to help if you need some kind of advice. So you might be worried that your employer owes you overtime and isn't paying it. That's a very common civil justice problem. Or you might be thinking about getting divorced or changing the custody arrangement with your kids. There's also no guarantee of assistance for that kind of civil justice problem either.
Yeah. So here we're talking about, it could be a wide range of things. Could have to do with conditions of employment, could be family law, divorce, child custody, things like that. It could be related to employment, or really a wide range of things. So when you're talking about everything that's not criminal that you might end up being in court for, we're covering a lot of territory here.
Absolutely. And it covers such a broad territory. That's why you have about half of households experiencing at least one civil justice problem at any time, which is well over in this country 100 million people affected by these problems.
Yeah. And it is the case that some places there is some help available. There are attorneys who are doing this for no fee. There are subsidized legal services. There are various ways that people can get information that is hoped they can use then to help themselves. But it's very patchy. And as I said, and as you found, it makes a whole lot of difference where it is you live, whether you can get access to services.
Absolutely. It almost completely depends on where you live. So you'll have many more opportunities to get help with these kinds of problems if you're in a big city, where there are more lawyers and more programs and more people who will volunteer. And if you're in a state that's relatively wealthy, because those states tend to – there's a minority of money that comes from a federal agency called the Legal Services Corporation. And what it does is fund lawyers who provide legal services to people who meet a means test for civil justice problems. And that means test is related to the federal poverty level. There are about 58 million people eligible for those services, and there are about 2,000 lawyers – funded by the Legal Services Corporation to serve them. So you can see there's a big ratio of eligible population to service population there. Those services are available. States that are relatively wealthy will supplement that federal money with different kinds of state money to provide more and more different kinds of services around the state. Poor states and states that are very rural are states where people often have great difficulty finding assistance for this wide range of problems.
Yeah. So what I would expect that, say, if you lived in, I don't know, Wyoming,
yes,
for example, it might be really difficult.
Or if you lived in rural Illinois.
Well, that would be my other thought, too, as well, that access to services, I expect, would be much better if you lived in the city of Chicago or if you lived in the collar counties than if you lived in the southern part of the state.
Yes. And states that have large rural populations have tried to come up with different ways to connect with those populations, like let's have a toll-free statewide hotline that you can call. And that hotline can take you a little ways, but there might not be a provider you could actually meet with, or if you're going to go to court, who could represent you in court in your immediate community. States have also tried to go to the internet as ways of providing this information, and that works well for some people because it's cheap. It's cheap to provide that information, and it's cheap to access it, but you have to have access to a computer, and you have to be able to read at a fairly high level to read the court form or something like that you might need to do this on your own.
Yeah, this perhaps may involve, this question may involve plunging too far into constitutional and legal history, but one might ask the question, well, why is it that we decided that it was important someone who was facing a criminal trial should have a lawyer, whether or not they could pay for it or not, but then somebody who was in one of these other situations, which, you know, it could be serious, it can involve, as I say, it could involve whether they worked or not. It could involve things like bankruptcy. It could involve things like child custody. It could have important ramifications for their health and their ability to make a living and do they have a roof over their head. But in all of those cases, we say, you're pretty much on your own.
The usual story about why we make that distinction is that the reason we have a right to counsel in a criminal context is that you could lose your physical liberty. You could actually be put in jail. And there are various groups around the country that are trying to expand the right to counsel over to at least part of the civil side. And one of the arguments they make is exactly the argument you just made, that there are some things that are such core human needs, like shelter, like the care of dependent people, whether those dependent people are your mentally ill adult child or your elderly parent or your own child or your, you know, minor age child, your ability to make a living. Those things are such central human needs that there ought to be some kind of guarantee of help for those kinds of things as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I suppose, too, it would when you look at where services are available, particularly the government money that goes into the services, that we'd say, well, yes, it's difficult in rural areas, whether it's a state where it's just thinly populated or a part of a state where most of the people are someplace else. But I think that you did find, though, that well, roughly speaking, though, resources are apportioned according to population. So, you know, maybe you shouldn't be surprised that, well, yeah, there are more resources going into Chicago, for example, than in southern Illinois, because that doesn't really help the people in southern Illinois.
Right. And some resources are apportioned according to population. So so federal resources are given out per capita. But money that states provide to support these programs or all of these programs are small public-private partnerships. So they get some portion of the money that lets them provide these services from some kind of government agency. And some of it will come from private foundations and private donations, law firms that make donations, the United Way, different kinds of programs like that. And all of that money isn't necessarily coordinated with the federal money, because you're just applying for grants for your great idea that you have for serving, you know, this part of the city of Chicago. So there's no way to allocate, when money's coming from 50 different places, there's no way to allocate it in a way that is necessarily makes what's available correspond to where the people are and what they need.
So this, I understand that this report that you were involved in putting together, Access Across America, nobody had ever tried to do this before, that is, come up with a comprehensive picture of across the country what it was that was available.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it grew out of this agency I talked about, the Legal Services Corporation, that funds about a third of legal aid in the U.S. And the Department of Justice, when the Obama administration came in, founded an Office of Access to Justice Initiatives. And with leadership from the Legal Services Corporation and that office in the Department of Justice, the foundation where I was working when this report started wanted to understand what are the resources that are available to people who face these very common, potentially very, very impactful problems around the country. And it was to just come up with a basic picture of what those services look like was the idea of this report, which no one had ever done before.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular – we can talk maybe in some detail about what's in the report, but were there any particular surprises? Was there anything that really emerged that a lot of people looked at and said, wow, that's really an important thing that we didn't know before?
I think one of the things that people who work in this area have been most surprised by is the incredible diversity of programs that have developed over the years. There's never enough money to provide services to everyone who needs them. So the Legal Services Corporation did a report just for its grantees, and they serve about 900,000 people a year of the 57 million who are eligible for these services. And they turn away about 1 million people a year because they don't have the resources to serve them. What programs have done in that context of small resources and big needs is try to come up with models where they can provide at least a limited amount of assistance to more people rather than a really intense assistance to a small group of people. And so there are medical legal partnerships. There are offices in courthouses that can help you figure out how to fill out the forms you need to do your uncontested divorce or respond to your notice of eviction from a landlord. There are kind of clinic-like programs where you come in and you do a workshop about some aspect of employment law and how to use the law to try to get what you feel like you deserve under employment law. There's just a variety of really creative ways that providers have come up with to do as much as they can with very limited resources.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in the Center of Focus is Rebecca Sandifer. She is a professor of sociology at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and has just recently published Access Across America, the first ever national and state-by-state portrait of services available to help people who are in a matter where they need help with a civil legal matter. So we're separating this from the criminal side, as we explained, and people understand if people are charged with a crime and they can't afford a lawyer, one's provided. But in civil cases, that is not the case. That right does not apply. There is no guarantee to counsel if you're involved in a civil matter, even though these things can be very, very important. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And you can, if you go on the web, you have internet access, and you'd like to read this report, you certainly can find it on the web. Well, I wonder in how many cases there are people who are able enough and their situation is simple enough so that with a little bit of advice, they can take care of themselves. And in how many cases is intense involvement by an attorney really necessary?
One of the things that we know is if you are not very good at speaking English, or if you have a physical disability or a cognitive disability, if you maybe have a job that doesn't allow you the flexibility to appear in court on your own behalf at the time when you would need to be there, those are the kinds of situations where people really need someone to assist them in moving through those processes. There are also legal problems that are very, very complex. Sometimes an eviction is pretty straightforward. So if you're being evicted for not paying the rent and you have the rent receipt, then you're okay. But sometimes it's more complicated. If you're making an argument about the conditions of the apartment or that the landlord violated the lease, or you have to prove that you didn't violate the lease. And so when the legal issues get complicated, even somebody who might have the time to sort of research it and be able to understand the basic issues might not have just the expertise to pursue that problem. States have moved around the country to make some of these processes simpler because courts feel overwhelmed by people who appear representing themselves or appear unrepresented by attorneys because those ordinary people don't know what the rules of engagement are in court. They don't know how to formulate things in terms of the very narrow categories that the law cares about. Judges get frustrated with them. Court clerks get frustrated with them. And so there are all kinds of innovative programs around the country that try to help people identify the legal issue, figure out how to phrase it in a way that the court personnel can understand and pursue it in court. But you have to not have anything holding you back in order to do that.
There are attorneys who provide this service, just like there are, I'm sure, in the case of people who are charged with crimes. There are attorneys who are willing to provide some time. They just give the time. There are attorneys that will do this for the civil side?
There are. And you can there are two kinds of attorneys that do this for free, in a sense. There are lots of organized civil pro bono programs that bring together attorneys who want to volunteer their time to help people who have these different sorts of problems. And then there are also attorneys who do, it's called freelance pro bono. So someone comes to them and says, I have this really serious problem. I'm very concerned about my mother. She can't take care of herself anymore. I need to be appointed her guardian to make sure that she pays her bills and has good health care and all these kinds of things. And that's a very complex process. And some attorneys will say, you know, I can see that you can't possibly afford to pay me for this legal work, so I'll either do it for free or you'll make a deal. It's called lo bono. So you'll pay that attorney much less than what he or she would make normally, and that attorney will do that service for you.
But that's this is something that people undertake just because they...
Because they're nice.
Because they're interested in helping out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is something also, there are law students that do this kind of thing?
So there are about, I want to say there are 120 or so law school clinics and law schools around the country that provide services in their communities. And most of them are pretty small scale, so they might serve 20 clients in a year. But some of them are like fully fledged offices. They'll serve 500, 1,000 clients over the course of a year. And that can have a big impact on the community where that law clinic is. And what happens in those situations is law students learn how to practice law by working with what's called live clients, real live clients who have actual justice problems, under the supervision of law professors. And then usually the clinics that have big businesses have staff attorneys. So it's not that you're just given a law student. That law student is being guided by a real attorney.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that gets to the question if one was going to be in the business of assisting people this kind of way, is it required that they be members of the bar? And I think that probably some people have made this argument and said, look, there's a great need for help here. And that with proper training, people could be taught how to help, and it might not necessarily have to be the case that they were lawyers, that they had a law degree. But I'm sure, as far as the lawyers are concerned, this is controversial.
It is, but you're absolutely right. So there are a variety of federal civil justice problems you might have. You might want to contest the denial of your unemployment benefits. You might be concerned that your TANF grant is going to be reduced. There are advocates who are not attorneys who are permitted to represent you in those federal forums. In some states have moved to license and permit certain kinds of non-lawyer assistance. So California has independent paralegals that can help you prepare the documentation for your divorce and figure out how to submit it and all that kind of thing. A number of states have immigration assistance to help you fill out the paperwork for, I guess now it's Homeland Security, for the process of applying for citizenship or other kinds of regularized statuses. And that's a trend that's increasing because the legal profession hasn't found a way to provide those services at a price that those populations can afford, and these other occupations have found models to do that. Yeah. And have gotten state legislatures to back them up.
Yeah. Well, it would make sense that if you had somebody who was going to provide, going to be an advocate in a very specific situation, they wouldn't have to know everything about every area of law.
That's right.
All they would have to know is just that. And it seems reasonable to that someone could be trained and educated in that aspect of the law so that they would be able to know how the form should be filled out, what the process was like, what people needed to do, and if that person had questions, they should be able to answer them.
Absolutely, yeah. And one of the models that people are trying to develop, that would be a for-fee service, right? And this is America, and we love markets, and so that would be mm-hmm. a great way of expanding access. One of the things that people are concerned about is can you embed that limited service in some kind of system where if it turns out somebody needs more than that, it gets caught somehow.
Yeah. But certainly before you don't want to get into court and then find out something was really not right.
Right.
Or something was not done correctly.
Yeah.
What about just the simple matter of people who need help, how it is they figure out where even to go to get help? I would imagine, for example, even if there were some lawyers who were willing to provide the service for free or for low cost, there might be some people who would say to themselves, well, I'm not even going to bother. What, I'm going to go into that lawyer's office, and as soon as that person finds out I can't really afford it, they're going to toss me out. They might not even think about going to a lawyer and asking questions about what kind of services that they could possibly expect.
That's one of the really striking things you find when you talk to people about their problems. Over the last few years, I've done some focus groups, not in this community, but in communities a lot like this, where I just invited people in and said, tell me about the kinds of problems that you have on a regular basis. And almost all of them end up being civil justice problems. They're problems with your employer or your mortgage or your spouse or your kids. And the first, I think, barrier to getting legal assistance is that people don't typically think of these as civil justice problems or as legal problems at all. They think of them as problems in relationships or problems about money. And when they talk about the kind of help that they want, they usually just say that they want help. So one of the people in these focus groups was a woman who was in her 70s. Her husband had recently died. He was a Navy veteran, and he was entitled to all kinds of both burial and death benefits and then insurance benefits during the time of his last illness. And she was trying to straighten out. Many times when you have to deal with insurance companies, it's very confusing and there are many errors and you have to straighten all this stuff out. So she was trying to straighten all this out, and she was still getting bills from hospitals for care that the hospitals claimed her husband was receiving after he was in fact deceased. And so all of this is the violation of contract law and insurance regulation and all these things. The way she put it was, I never realized there were so many dishonest people in this country. And it had never occurred to her that a lawyer might be able to help her straighten some of that out. When people talk about what they want for these problems, they'll usually just say, I want help. They don't necessarily want legal help. Now, once you decide that maybe this is something that an attorney could help you with, it's sometimes easy and sometimes hard to figure out where to go. So the free legal assistance that would be available to someone who met the means test usually isn't called free legal assistance for someone who meets the means test. It's usually called like the Law Foundation of the Prairie or something like that. Yeah. So there are some branding issues that I think would increase access a great deal. If these things had clearer names, people would know that that's what they did.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Rebecca Sandifer. She's a professor of sociology at University of Illinois. We're talking about the problem of the lack of legal services for people who have civil law matters that they're involved in. And this is something that she has looked at in a report that she's authored. It's recently come out, Access Across America. This is a report that was released by the American Bar Foundation, and it looks at state by state what kind of services are available to people who may not have the means to go out and hire a lawyer but need help with civil legal matters. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you'd like to put in your question that way, will-talk at illinois.edu. Here's someone who writes in an email, and this is, in a sense, this is the same thing that we were talking about, wondering, how do you go about finding a lawyer that is willing to help either at a low or no cost? Is there some kind of database for lawyers like this?
It depends on where you are. If you're in Illinois, there are a couple of places where you could start if you're looking for either free or low-cost assistance. One is to go to the internet and go to www.lsc.gov, which is the Legal Services Corporation, which is this federal agency that you're paying for with, we're all paying for with our taxes, that is funding some of these services. And they will tell you state by state who the LSC-funded providers are in every state. You can then call the one that's, and they're usually set up by county. So find your county, call the one that serves your county. They'll put you through the means test. If you don't make the means test, if your income isn't low enough, they usually have a bank of people that they can refer you to. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it, I don't know what the coverage is for Illinois on this one, but it's called Law Help. And it's another one, law, I think it's lawhelp.com. And it's another web service that that aggregates information about attorneys that will provide different kinds of services for reduced fees, or you can work out payment plans, things like that.
Mm, okay. Other questions, certainly welcome. So tell me, as a sociologist, how is it that you got interested in this particular subject?
I wrote the world's most boring dissertation on the careers of attorneys. And after I spent a lot of time studying attorneys, I thought, why do we spend all this time studying attorneys? And the reason is that they are the gatekeepers. They're a private occupation that is the gatekeeper of a big public legal system that we've all already paid for, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting situation. I mean, we've all also already paid for a system of public education, but you are not required to hire a tutor, for example. You can if you want to, but you're not required to hire a tutor to use the third grade for your child. There's a whole set of public things where the services provided are simple enough or accessible enough that you don't need to find this other occupation. And so I wanted to understand how people, ordinary people who have justice problems, navigate this situation. What do you do when you want to use your public legal system, but it's so complicated that you need help, and you have to buy that help somewhere? How do you handle those kinds of situations? And the answer is that for the most part, people either do nothing about their civil justice problems or they try to solve them on their own in a whole variety of ways. And some of the services that are available today are there to help you solve them on your own without an attorney. And sometimes when you try to solve it on your own, things work out great. And sometimes it's a terrible disaster.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens to people for whom it ends up being a terrible disaster?
Their credit ratings fall into the low 300s because they can't resolve the consequences of someone stealing their identity. Or they can't figure out how to set up a guardianship for their parent, and so then their parent gets their house sold in order to put them in a nursing home, and the child loses any kind of control over the parent's care and loses any of the assets that the family might have wanted to try to retain. Mm-hmm. Or you lose custody of your kids. Or you lose your home or the place where you're living. You might double up with relatives of yours, which means that if you have kids, your kids are maybe switching schools, and that's very disruptive for them. Or you might become homeless because you don't have time. You know, you don't have the resources to back you up when you lose your first shelter. Yeah.
We'll talk some more with our guest in this hour of focus, Rebecca Sandifer. She's a sociologist here at University of Illinois. We're talking about access to civil legal services here across the country. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Astrophysicist Saul Perlmutter was part of the team awarded the 2011 Nobel Prize for the discovery that the expansion of the universe wasn't slowing down, but accelerating.
What we were seeing was a little bit like throwing the apple up in the air and it blasting off into space.
Saul Perlmutter explains it on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, and thousands of accessories at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be environmentalist Annie Leonard. She's director of the Story of Stuff Project. She's going to be visiting here in Champaign-Urbana. She authored a book titled The Story of Stuff, which takes a look at all of the things that we buy, all of the manufactured objects that we surround ourselves with, where they come from and where they go when we throw them away. And it deals with the problem of consumption and its environmental impact and how we think about our well-being, all good things to be thinking about and talking about. So she'll be with us in the first hour tomorrow. Also tomorrow, we'll be talking about hunger in central Illinois. And this is part of a big day of programming that we'll be doing on WILL radio and television. In the morning, tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, we will talk on the show about some of the efforts here in Central Illinois to deal with hunger. We'll have two guests, Mike Meese, who is the administrator of the Midwest Food Bank that covers Peoria and Bloomington, particularly those cities. And also joining us will be Tracy Smith, the Illinois State Director for Feeding Illinois, which is the network of food banks here in Illinois. We'll try to talk a little bit about the basic problem. Then tomorrow night on WILO-TV, at 8 o'clock, we'll be doing a special program focusing on efforts, largely people-to-people efforts in Central Illinois to help with the problem of hunger. And certainly something that we know as we have talked to people who run food pantries and the people who manage food banks, that particularly within the last couple of years, the need for food almost sometimes on an emergency basis has gone up really dramatically. So we'll talk about some of this. We'll have people who are from food pantries and from food banks. We'll talk about SNAP, which is now what they call the program that we used to call food stamps, and try to get a sense of what services are available and also talk about what kind of support organizations like this need. So that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock on WILL-TV, our companion television station. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And also here in studio, we're happy to have as our guest Rebecca Sandifer. She is a professor of sociology here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and has just recently published a report. This has been released by the American Bar Foundation, Access Across America, first ever national and state-by-state portrait of services available to help people in accessing civil justice. So questions are welcome. In fact, we have somebody here ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's caller in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Rebecca, I used to be a case manager with senior citizens in Sangamon County, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. I handle the guardianship case. They do have caseworkers that do that for people who are under asset. And we worked up a case with a team of professionals and took it to court. And it required, of course, my case notes, which showed that this person needed guardianship. And there are private case managers that are wealthy. I mean, it helps the wealthy also. With this particular guardianship situation or anything else they have to deal with the elderly. My question is there anyone out there, any attorneys, any legal assistance for the Occupy CU movement, like on foreclosures?
That's a really interesting question. It's great to know that in this community, there exist resources to assist people who are dealing with guardianships, because this is obviously something that's going to become a more and more common problem as the population ages. And the program that you describe is one of these great examples of really creative ways of solving potentially very impactful problem. I don't know who is assisting Occupy CU.
We have to leave it at that. Maybe there is somebody else who is listening who can come up with an answer. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I do think, am I right in remembering from having looked at the report that there are specific groups that have that do have money or systems set aside to help them with civil matters? And I thought that the elderly, senior citizens, was one of those groups.
Yes, there are special programs for the elderly, for people with disabilities, for people with a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS, for American Indian groups, and for homeless folks, and for veterans.
Okay. So that certainly, though, leaves vast numbers of people who don't fall into any of those kinds of categories.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting question. Again, this is something that has come in by email. The person who is listening is wondering, well, is this issue unique to the United States? And if not, how do other nations make sure that their populations get some representation when they have to deal with civil issues?
That's a great question. The U.S. is really different from our peer nations. So we're very different from Canada, for instance, or from the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, it doesn't have a right to counsel, but it has a really, really generous civil legal aid system so that for a certain set of problems, you will get, paid for by the government, an attorney to assist you with that problem. It also has this huge network of non-lawyer legal advice providers. And the centerpiece of this is an agency called the Citizens Advice Bureau. And the Citizens Advice Bureau started right after World War II, when there were all kinds of people who had moved. They had made precipitous wartime marriages. There was all this dislocation. And so there were enormous numbers of servicemen and their wives who wanted to get divorced from their precipitous marriages. And people who had, you know, lost their homes in the bombing of London and all this stuff. They had all kinds of problems. And so they developed a legal aid scheme and this advice scheme where non-lawyers could give you legal advice to help the population with all of these problems. And it became a big public system of providing civil legal assistance. The big difference between Britain and the United States is that in Britain, anybody can provide legal advice. You don't have to be an attorney. And in the United States, only attorneys for most problems can provide legal advice. So you have a much more differentiated system in the UK.
How did that one get by the British lawyers?
They don't seem to mind. I think in part it grew out of this moment when everybody was in the post-war trauma together. The British legal profession is also much smaller than the American legal profession. So we have about 1 million lawyers for our 308 million people, and they have a much smaller ratio of lawyers to the population.
All right. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe we could get back to the funding question, because we talked a little bit about this, but this is one of the major areas that you look at, and that is where the money comes from. Now, we have talked about the fact that there is federal money, somewhat supplemented somewhat by state money. Is that where the biggest chunk of money is coming from to try to provide these kind of legal services, that is ultimately from the federal government?
The Legal Services Corporation, no one knows how much money supports this work. It's about $1.4 billion in the context of a multi-trillion dollar budget, and in the context of probably $230 billion of spending on criminal justice, so police, courts, public defenders, and all that. So it's not a lot of money, but of those $1.4 billion, maybe 40% is federal. The biggest chunk of that is this Legal Services Corporation money. There is state money. There are local governments that support the provision of civil legal assistance. And then there are all kinds of private foundations and aggregated donations that support this work. So it was a system that started as a basically federally funded system, but it's become this huge network of public-private partnerships that relies on all kinds of sources of funding to do this work.
And is this a little bit different every place you go?
Absolutely.
Where, just as I've mentioned a couple times that what this report does access across America is that it looks, go state by state and looks at what kind of thing is available in any particular state. So you can, for people here who are listening around us, they can go there and they can look. But if we open, as you have it in front of you, if you open the report to that section that's on Illinois, just can you talk a little bit about Illinois and maybe how is Illinois fairly representative in what's available, or is it different in some particular way?
Illinois is a big state, so it's 13 or 14 million people. It's on the low end in terms of producing its own money to support these kinds of services. There's not much state money that comes in Illinois. In 2009, it was about $2 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but it's not a lot in the national perspective. Illinois has a number of innovative programs, many of which are operating in Chicago. So medical legal partnerships. One of the new things that providers are trying to do is to meet people where they are. And that's what the court-based self-help is. So you show up at court with your problem, and we're going to help you there. Medical legal partnerships with social service agencies of different kinds. So people come in with a problem that they may not recognize could use legal help, and then you spring the legal help on them while they're there. And Illinois is one of the leaders in those kinds of innovative services.
Just, I guess I'm going back to the, you know, you're talking about having had the experience of talking with people who had problems, and you were just you were just talking with people and you were just saying to them sort of like, well, you know, tell me about what are the biggest challenges that you face in your life? What are the big things that you're wrestling with? And that many of them turned out to be things that touched on or involved civil law. And yet at the same time, you said that, you know, when you asked people what they were looking for, they said, well, I really need help with this. But they didn't say, I need a lawyer.
Right.
And I need legal help. I guess, you know, back to this thing of, well, how do you get people to understand that kind of help is available, or that maybe that's the kind of help that they need? And then once they've gotten to that point is, well, how do you get them and the people who are willing to provide the help together? And, you know, I suppose one of the things is, well, you have people at the courthouse ready and waiting. And hopefully when people show up, they'll come down to the courthouse and you'll be able to say, well, okay, here you go. Here you got somebody right here who can help.
I think one of the best things that we could do is do outreach about specific problems. So rather than, hi, I'm an attorney, I can help you, or I'm a legal services program, I can help you, you know, do you have problems with is the heat working in your apartment? That's a fairly common conditions problem in cheap rental housing. You know, do you have an elderly parent and you don't know how to take care of that person? And so because those are the problems that people perceive that they have, real problems of everyday life that cause them great difficulty. And so learning more about how people think about themselves, these problems on their own, I think would tell us a lot about how to do more effective outreach and to reach people better. Mm.
Questions are certainly welcome. We are talking here this morning with Rebecca Sandifer. She's professor of sociology here at University of Illinois. We're talking about access to civil justice here in the United States, something that she has done a survey of and has just published a report that deals state by state with what's available. Access Across America is what it's called. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, and that address is will-talk at illinois.edu. Well, what, you know, as people, this may be a little bit more prospective, but as people, particularly people in government and in the legal profession, think about this, clearly there's a big unmet need. So how is it that people are thinking about the possibility of getting that need met? And when you, it was just really striking when you talked before about how much money we spend on legal matters in this country, and then the relatively small amount of money that's directed into programs that are designed to help people who need help who can't get it for themselves.
There are a couple of kinds of efforts that are underway right now. So one of them is an effort driven by cause lawyers, or lawyers who have a vision of a better world and they want to work for that particular vision. And that's to have a right to counsel for civil matters. Sometimes they call it a civil Gideon because of that famous case, Gideon versus Wainwright, which was made into a movie with Fonda, right?
Yeah, well, that's why we
know
that
your criminal lawyer.
If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be provided.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So they'd like to get a parallel right enshrined in the Constitution for at least a subset of civil problems, the ones that really affect those core areas of life like shelter, the care of dependents, the ability to make a living, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's one effort that's underway. The other thing that people are starting to think about in different states, because states have leadership that worries about these problems and their access to justice commissions and the state legislature and so on, is given that we have these very restricted resources right now and are likely to for a while, what can we do to use them more efficiently? So how can we coordinate these services in a way that makes the best use of what it is that we have? Mm-hmm. Those are very different responses to the same kind of problem. Of course, everyone would like to see more money. It's likely that the Legal Services Corporation, that central federal funding agency, will get its budget cut this year because most social and human services are going to get their budgets cut this year.
Mm-hmm. How did anybody talking about how much?
I believe they've asked for something in the $400 million, and they're going to get something in the high $300 million. But wow. But it hasn't been settled yet.
Yeah. Just to go back to the first thing, changing the Constitution is hard.
It is.
It was made that way on purpose. I mean, I think the idea of, you know, for good or ill, and probably for ill, probably for good, is that, well, it should be hard, you know, to do that. So the idea that you could get something into the Constitution that would say, you know, this right we say that you have to representation in a criminal case, but we're also going to say that if you need civil representation, that's also I can't hardly imagine such a thing happening. Is there much weight behind that?
There have been. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I should say that. But there have been two or three test cases in the last few years, and they have not been successful so far. And my prediction would be that probably we won't find a right. There are other ways to make something. I mean, the system I was describing in Great Britain, there's no right. It's just the system had the people of Britain have decided that this is a service that will be provided when we think people need it, and they've defined when we think people need it. So there are other ways to make something universally available besides writing it in the Constitution.
Yeah, that though that it would require though people in large numbers saying, recognizing that there is a need,
absolutely,
and that it was something that we were expecting that society and government would respond to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Does that suggest that perhaps that people generally don't appreciate the fact that there is this need? I guess I'm going back to your thing where people said, well, they were having these problems, but somehow didn't recognize they were problems that were, I don't know if it was that they were not recognizing that they were problems of a legal nature, or that involved the law, or that they could use legal help. I guess I'm not really sure why people right away, you know, for all we hear about it's being a very litigious society, why right away people don't say, well, what I need is a lawyer.
I think the idea that we live in a very litigious society comes from very spectacular cases that get picked up by the media, like the McDonald's coffee case, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at that and you think, well, I've spilled coffee on myself and I haven't sued anyone. What is happening to our society? But the thing I think that most surprises people when I talk about civil justice problems in the U.S. is the vast scope of these problems and the enormous numbers of people who have them. Millions and millions of people right now facing threats to their shelter, facing difficulties taking care of dependents, facing serious worries about livelihood, being unable to pay their bills, all kinds of things. I think if people recognize that A, these problems are very common and almost everyone is at risk of having them. They're not poor people's problems. Middle-income people have these problems as well. So I think part of it is just recognizing that this stuff is rife in a society where so many things are governed by contracts and regulations and so on. Getting people to recognize that they're legal, I'm not sure it's necessary that that's the only way that they could be solved. People could resolve these problems in other kinds of ways with other kinds of services. I think there is a set of them where you want the justice system to be working because that's how you create compliance with laws. And identifying that set of problems and educating people about problems that they really should be using law to enforce, I think, would be very valuable.
We have another caller here, someone to talk with in Fusland. Line number one, right here. Hello.
Yes, I went through a divorce where my ex-wife had the University of Illinois represent her, and we went through 14 senior law students over a 6-year period. And it was a nightmare. It cost us everything. So, you know, I don't know what you recommend in a situation like that, but I would like to hear your comment.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for the trouble that you and your family have faced. Divorces can be, especially if there are issues that are contested, can take a really long time and be incredibly expensive, $90,000, $150,000, very, very expensive legal problems. One thing that some countries have considered is de-judicializing divorce. So you don't need a lawyer or a court process to get married. should you need a lawyer or a court process to get divorced. Japan, I think, just did this. You can now just kind of go down to the courthouse and sign your divorce papers just like you get your marriage license. So there are ways to simplify legal processes that might make a lot of this a lot easier and a lot cheaper for many people. Again, that you want to do that in a way that lets you catch situations where maybe you want it to be complicated. So situations where there's some threat to children or you're worried about domestic violence or something like that in a family kind of problem, or other situations where the legal issues are really complex and you don't want people to try to solve them on their own.
It does not this specific case, but the matter of divorce and maybe other situations too. It does also make me think about the value of some kind of mediation process to help resolve things before you get to the point of being in the courtroom. That would suggest that possibly things might be resolved without going to court, or at least if things do end up going to court, then you can go before your judge and say, look, Your Honor, we pretty much have things worked out. Here's what it looks like. And maybe that at least would make some possibility for working things out. And I think that there are some places that actually, when it comes to divorce, mediation is actually required before people go to court.
Absolutely. There are employment disputes where mediation is required. There are jurisdictions where they require mediation between tenants and their landlords when there are disputes there. Lawyers argue about this a lot. I mean, many of those mediators are attorneys. Mediation is great because it allows people to arrive at some kind of agreement that hopefully they both buy into. It's a situation where you want to – maybe there are situations where you don't want to have people come into an agreement where one of them is much more powerful than the other, or where there's some fear or something like that. So there have to be ways to identify that core set of problems that really ought to be handled in a traditional legal way and distinguish them from the other problems that we might be able to handle in these many more creative, cheaper, easier, less conflictual ways.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point we're going to have to finish. I just want to mention one more time that for people who are interested in this particular issue, you can read the report that I have referred to now a number of times, Access Across America. It's been released by the American Bar Foundation by our guest, Rebecca Sandifer. She's professor of sociology at the University of Illinois. If you have web access, you can find it. And I think probably if you just put Access Across America into your browser, you will find the report and you can take a look at it. And to you, Professor Sandifer, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.